But now here on Radio 3, it's 7:30, and time to go live to the Royal Albert Hall for this evening's prom. Over now to Martin Handley.
Thanks very much indeed, Sean. Hello and welcome to the Albert Hall for tonight's BBC prom, in which Russian artists perform Russian music. The young pianist Daniil Trifonov makes his prom's debut in something of a rarity, not least at the proms, for which this is the premiere of Glazunov's autumnal second piano concerto. Valery Gergiev, principal conductor of the orchestra on stage now, the London Symphony, also leads them in the richly coloured gallery tour that is Mussorgsky's Pictures at an Exhibition in its brilliant orchestration by Ravel. Before that, we have a UK premiere of Sofia Gubaidulina's The Rider on the White Horse, a fiery portrait of the first of the four horsemen of the apocalypse. But the LSO and Valery Gergiev begin with Borodin's Second Symphony. I asked Valery why we should love this piece.
There are many reasons, I think, to love this symphony and to love this composer. Melodist, colorist, chemist. This symphony stands out in a way because not only it's called Bagatyrskaya, Bagatyrskaya means a mighty, epic hero, you know, epic hero, epic. So the symphony sounds this way. But there are wonderful lyrical colors as well.
Borodin's dual career as chemistry professor and composer did mean that his large-scale compositions were apt to remain works in progress for years. So it was with his opera Prince Igor and his Second Symphony, each being laid aside several times to continue work on the other. So with their intermingled composition, it's not surprising that the Second Symphony expresses the epic spirit of Prince Igor. As Valery Gergiev said, Borodin told a friend that of the four movements, the first recalls the chivalry of their valiant ancestors, the knights or bogatyrs. In the slow movement, the Slavic bard Bayan sings of impending danger, struggle and victory, before the finale represents a festival of the heroes of Kiev with feasting and revelry and the people rejoicing. I'm still a bit of business going on the stage, some microphones being adjusted, chairs being removed, and another chair being brought back. It's chair wars here. I think they forgot that there was an extra second violinist. But in the midst of all that, as you can hear, the orchestra is being tuned. Borodin's own version of his packed life, as he wrote to his wife, was the difficulty of being at one and the same time both a composer and a civil servant, scientist, commissioner, artist, government official, philanthropist, father of other people's children, doctor and invalid. You end up by becoming only the last. That applause for tonight's leader of the London Symphony Orchestra, Carmine Lowry. Just await Valery Gergiev. That wonderful hushed moment in the hall, absolutely packed again. And Maestro Gergiev is never the quickest on after the leader. There's always this moment of bated breath. First performance, incidentally, of Borodin's Second Symphony wasn't a great success. It was put down to sluggish conducting, no danger of that tonight, and over-enthusiastic brass orchestration by the composer. Valery Gergiev has balanced that impeccably, and here he comes to conduct Borodin's Second Symphony. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll be right back.
Revelry from the epic ancient Russian world of his opera Prince Igor, ending Borodin's Second Symphony, played here at the Royal Albert Hall to open tonight's BBC Prom, live of course here on Radio 3, home of the Proms, by the London Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Valery Gergiev. Back he comes onto the platform. I think I know who he's going to bring to his feet. It will be a hymn. Yes, it's Timothy Jackson, guest, principal horn, principal clarinet, Christopher Richards, creating a wonderful atmosphere in the slow movement. Rimsky-Korsakov conducted the second performance of that symphony, which was a terrific success. And Rimsky and Mussorgsky called the piece a lioness. Borodin was able to write to his wife that the two fellow composers are mad about the finale of my symphony. It's turned out first rate. I myself am very pleased with it. Strong, powerful, dashing and effective. Well, now we've a piano move before Daniel Trifonov can make his Proms debut in the first Proms performance, 96 years after it was written, of Glazunov's second piano concerto. Daniel Trifonov really burst on the scene 2 years ago when, after winning prizes at the Chopin and Rubinstein competitions, he was awarded the Grand Prix at the biggest of them all, the Tchaikovsky. And since then, everybody's aware that he's a special artist, including his fellow pianists. Proms featured artist Imogen Cooper is here at the hall to hear Daniel this evening.
I first came across Trifonov when I was watching the Chopin competition in Warsaw, online actually. I was actually following somebody else on the competition, and I came across this young boy who was playing the Chopin Polonaise Fantasy. No pushover as a work, it's a very difficult work to bring off. And it was wonderful, it was really wonderful. Intelligent musicianship, already very mature. Lots of ideas, but all extremely fresh and natural, nothing contrived at all. Pianism in spades, we don't even have to talk about that. Beautiful sound, very personal sound. Focus, involvement. You just listened and thought, yes.
Daniel Trifonov may be only 22, but he's positively elderly compared to Glazunov, who was just 16 when his first symphony was premiered and was regarded as a precocious star of the musical world. 5 years later, after Borodin's sudden death in the wake of that writing the Second Symphony, Glazunov and Rimsky-Korsakov decided to complete and orchestrate his manuscripts. Glazunov was later made professor of composition and orchestration at the St. Petersburg Conservatoire and became director in 1905 when he was 40. After that, Glazunov wrote very little music. He worked hard in his stressful new job. He was still living with his mother. Perhaps it's not surprising that alcohol played a major part in his life. One of Glazunov's pupils in his last years in St. Petersburg was Shostakovich. In his memoirs, he asks his readers if they know the line from a Russian children's story about how hard it is to pull a hippo from a swamp. Well, says Shostakovich, I'm pulling a hippo from the swamp of my memory, and the hippo's name is Glazunov. He is a good, kind and helpful hippo. As I reminisce about this major Russian musician and great Russian man, I become agitated. I knew him well, and today's generation virtually doesn't know him at all. For today's young musicians, Glazunov is like some Slavic wardrobe from grandfather's collection of furniture. Well, I asked Daniel Trifonov about Glazunov's music, and the second piano concerto in particular.
Actually, this piece, it's not only been premiered at Proms, but in general, this piece is very rarely performed, and there are only few existing recordings of this piece. And among the great pianists of the past, Richter, he recorded first concerto. But in my opinion, this second concerto is even more colorful, even more charming than a previous one.
So why, Daniel, is this concerto played so rarely?
Well, this is an incredibly challenging piece for the ensemble, and you need an extremely sensitive orchestra and incredibly flexible conductor, as there are lots and lots of tempo changes. I would say in a finale, for example, 2 bars one tempo, next 4 bars another tempo, then again 2 bars another tempo, and
it's fiendish, I noticed.
Yeah, and everyone have to be incredibly alert to the every subtle change the music brings.
How does the piano writing compare? We always think of Glazunov in terms of Rachmaninoff and the famous horrible performance of the first symphony, you know, which is very unfair on a great musician. How does the piano writing in this concerto compare with that of Rachmaninoff?
Well, of course, it's very different. Always the piano writing of composers who were also pianists is completely different from the, for example, Tchaikovsky concerto being an incredible piece. It bears a lot of challenges in terms of unpianistic parts.
Glazunov wasn't really a pianist, was he? I mean, he played, but...
This concerto has a really colorful writing for the piano. At times it is challenging, especially on a forte, for example, as he does not usually produce the same thickness, harmonical thickness of piano writing in a forte. So in order for piano to be really audible, it has to be very clear.
Did you enjoy that rehearsal in this hall?
Oh, of course, it's such a historical place, and it's an incredible feeling to be performing on this stage. But of course, I'm aware that usually when an audience comes in, acoustic slightly changes.
Will change. So, and you've worked quite a lot with Valery Gergiev. He does negotiate that last movement of the Glazunov with great ease, doesn't he? And assist you.
This is an incredibly challenging concerto, and I'm very happy that the orchestra is able to so carefully listen.
Tonight's soloist, Daniil Trifonov. Well, Glazunov wrote his second piano concerto in 1917, really late in his career. There's no real sign in the music of the tense situation going on in the world outside his cramped St. Petersburg flat. The structure of the concerto, according to Trifonov, owes a lot to Liszt, with four movements within a single whole. The first of them begins in a mellow and autumnal mood before turning more muscular. The short, slow movement is lyrically idyllic before a balletic scherzo and a finale which grows to a glittering finish. As you heard from the promenaders, all is ready. The lid of the piano is lifted. And we await soloist and conductor. And here they are. Tonight's proms debutant, Daniil Trifonov, followed by Valery Gergiev, and joining the LSO to perform Glazunov's second piano concerto. A glittering, triumphant end to what seemed to be a very autumnal work. Glazunov's second piano concerto performed here in the Royal Albert Hall and live on Radio 3 by Daniil Trifonov with the London Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Valery Gergiev. And just as it was Daniil Trifonov's proms debut, so it was the concerto's proms premiere, almost exactly 100 years since the proms premiere of Glazunov's first concerto. I don't know if Glazunov was at Queen's Hall for it. I tried to find out today. Henry Wood conducted, and a young pianist called Alfred Quaife was the soloist. Back comes Daniil Trifonov, incredibly focused at the keyboard. Focused, passionate playing. He's obviously delighted, went straight to Valery Gergiev, who was organizer, really, of the Tchaikovsky competition. So there's obviously been something of a mentor since Daniil won it. They've worked together a lot. Very grateful to have Valery Gergiev conducting in that elusive piece, and very complex rhythmically, particularly in the finale, as Daniil was saying. And if you enjoyed that, by the way, and you weren't listening to Through the Night last night, and why should you have been? You might have wanted to sleep. Then there was a recital. One of his own pieces, as well as Mettner, Debussy, Chopin, Scriabin. We're going to get some more right now.
Thank you.
Infernal Dance from Stravinsky's Firebird Ballet, arranged by Guido Agusti. And you can hear more from that Firebird arrangement if you tune to the website and listen to the Through the Night recital. And Daniel will be back at the Aspen Music Festival on Friday, playing Mozart's German Concerto and playing lots of recitals, including on the 1st of September at Vevey in Switzerland, the world premiere of his sonata. He tells me he's busy writing a piano concerto at the moment. He's written it, really. He's just orchestrating it. I don't know how he finds time to do it. He's still studying at the Cleveland Institute of Music. Back he is on the platform. I think these are the opening salvos in what is going to be a quite astonishing career, I would venture to suggest. Just the way he plays, as Imogen Cooper was saying at the beginning, something very special. Well, after the interval here in the Royal Albert Hall, the LSO and its principal conductor, Valery Gergiev, turn from a proms premiere to a UK premiere of a work by one of the doyens of Russian composers, Sofia Gubaidulina, whose music always engages both head and heart. This evening, it's her portrayal of the first of the four horsemen of the apocalypse, which she calls the Rider on the White Horse. If that's one portrait, then after it, Mussorgsky and Ravel take us on a tour around a whole gallery in pictures at an exhibition. Even Glazunov finally left Russia to spend his last years in Paris. But for all Russians who went into exile around the time of the revolution, there was naturally always a strong pull to go back home. In tonight's 20 Minutes here on Radio 3, the historian and writer Leslie Chamberlain tells the story of an exile from the Soviet Union who couldn't keep away from her mother country.
Exile is probably not, now that most of us can move where we want to, the drama and the challenge it was when the politics of nations erected many barriers. Europe last saw it on a huge scale when thousands of Jews, not enough, fled from Nazi Germany. Exile is not a matter of being a temporary refugee. For much or all of a lifetime, exiles can't return to their native country. The Cold War brought handfuls of political exiles west. Of the 1.5 million refugees who have fled the present conflict in Syria, some perhaps will want and not be able to return. Exile happens when political regimes change violently. The winners take power, the losers either fall silent and disguise themselves or go into exile. Much of my work in Russian history has traced the lives of exiles from the Bolshevik Revolution in 1917, the biggest such group before the Second World War. Whether they wished it or not, around 150,000 aristocrats, the core of what was called White Russia, and more than 1 million others who would not have answered to that description, had to get out or be killed because of their political past or their social class. While Russia was red, or Bolshevik, or Soviet, they had no country to return to for most of the rest of the 20th century. New lives had to be made, or old ones more or less preserved, on foreign soil. I've become specially interested in the women caught up in the great emigration after 1917. Like the heroine of my novel, Anyone's Game, they were innocent of politics, simply born on the wrong side in a vicious civil war. The real woman I want to talk about here, Sophie Dolgoruki, spent the rest of her life improvising, partly in England, partly abroad, never quite forgetting the Russia she belonged to. To settle and make a home was difficult. Her autobiography, Sofka, The Autobiography of a Princess, published in 1968 when she was 61, still brings tears to my eyes. It's full of the kind of honesty and courage that perilous situations can bring out. She was also quite a woman. Dolgoruki was perhaps the most illustrious family name any Russian could bear. The proud and lofty Dolgorukis were 7 centuries older than the ruling Romanov Tsars. From childhood, Sofka's behaviour had to be impeccable, the social niceties finely observed. I met her in her late 60s when she was living with the last of her many partners, Jack King, on Bodmin Moor in Cornwall. And I can vouch for the touch of hauteur coupled with a flirtatious girlishness that accompanied her throughout her life. She was always a glamorous rebel who spoke her mind, and it helped her to survive. Her good fortune, her trump card, as she put it, was to have had an English governess from the age of 4. So she had a country to gravitate towards, and a place where she might earn her living. After the revolution, the family, including the British Queen Alexandra's sister, moved to the Crimea to escape a dangerous Moscow. But the situation in the south also deteriorated. When the Royal Navy sailed to Yalta on the Black Sea to rescue our own monarchy's beleaguered relative, amid much curtsying, Sofka, aged 11 in 1918, also left on a British ship. With her went her mother, stepfather, and her governess. In Malta, Rome, Paris, and London, she led a life at once cared for and neglected. Her mother, an intellectually demanding woman, independent-minded, and who had ambitions to be a doctor and became a pilot, never seemed to be there. Privileged, everyone the Dolgorukis knew seemed to have a villa to spare or a spacious apartment, but perennially uprooted and short of cash, Sofka grew up, unorthodoxly educated, very bright, polyglot, she spoke at least 5 languages, and great fun. The family's first response to exile was to sell the jewels and live economically while waiting for the old life to be resumed. Quite early, Sofka realised that that wasn't going to happen. In fact, she never questioned the rightness of the revolution after her childhood friendships with servants on the family estate had convinced her of the unfairness of the old system. When she got to England in 1926, the year of the Great Strike, she wondered why there wasn't a revolution here too. She was vividly aware that her native social world was disappearing, although she couldn't entirely shake it off. She said, "We were the betwixt and between generation, surrounded by the traditions of the old world, the vestiges of which clung to us in our youth like a hangover." She initially married into a grand Russian-speaking Serbian family also exiled in London. Yet, because of her politics and the quality of her mind, she was always different. She grew up an instinctive socialist. There was an occasion when a cousin campaigning for a parliamentary seat in Glasgow Govan persuaded Sofka and a friend to get out on the trail. They were so shocked by the poverty they met, not the grand dame economising they knew from their own difficulties, but the real horror of living 10 to a room with no food for the children. They were so shocked that they attended a Labour Party meeting instead and went over to the other side. You probably have to read Sofka for yourself to grasp all the contradictions and the hope and the tragedy she lived. Hers was the grand life, with young men taking her for a spin in their tiger moths and champagne fizzing everywhere, and then having to take in lodgers when her first husband, the high-born but unsuitable Leo, lost his job in the Depression. She said she always felt the foreigner and the outsider wherever she went, although evidently she charmed people, or not quite. I suppose that part of life's teaching is not to act out of character, even if that character is unpleasant, she wrote of her impatience with those she found dull and conventional and not worthy of her attention. One of those soon to be her ex-husband, Leo. When she discovered sex, not young but before her marriage, she wrote of that lovemaking that the intensity was unequalled, and in relationships one learns that it is the strength of the feeling that really counts, far more than the happiness of the outcome. Not the wisest words a woman ever wrote, but yes, why settle for less? The love of her life was an ethereal young man who came for Russian lessons and just happened to be the son of a baronet. Her autobiography sings gaily in spite of all sorts of difficulties, but the music soars in the mid-1930s when in her late 20s she's happy with Gray Skipwith. They have a child, Patrick, to add to the two sons she already has by Leo. But Grey and Sofka are young and not terribly keen to be limited by a child, and so Patrick is taken care of here and there while his parents camp out and party with Cossacks on a British tour. All this in the blissful years when they rent a house in Cookham Green, close to the Thames. In between swimming and naked sunbathing, they get a frightening inkling of what the rise of Hitler means, sympathise with Jewish friends, and half-heartedly try to read Marx and Lenin. Then it's September 1939, war breaks out, and they go their separate ways. To pay the rent for 6 months in Cookham, Sofka spends a month in Paris. All her life, in fact, she's as drawn to Paris as London. But then she can't get back. And she's interned in Besançon and later in Vittel, holiday resorts converted into wretched detention camps. Meanwhile, her husband has become a gunner in the RAF. She's afraid for him, but believes he must do what he wants. The section of Sofka's memoirs dealing with the war stands out even from the extraordinariness of her flight from Russia and her domestic revels and ruses in peacetime. She was in Paris, not yet in captivity, but unable to return to England, when the Germans arrived in June 1940. Food was scarce, but somewhere along the line she learnt to knit and now produced pullovers and dresses for good money. There was also a job at the US Embassy, yet another occasion when, no doubt, she could play the trump card of her English, on top of knowing French, and marry it with the shorthand typing. Internment meant poor food and sanitation and bugs in the bed and 40 to a dorm. But now the trump card was her personality. She was able to take charge. She wrote, "Washing was difficult, stone troughs interspersed with cold water taps jutting over them at intervals, in an icy room, with an equally cold, water-splashed stone floor. Suddenly, one day, it was announced over the tannoy that there would be hot showers in the bathhouse at 2 o'clock. With hundreds of women battling to get in, I whipped a piece of paper and pencil out of my pocket and began taking names. That was the most rewarding, spontaneous act of my existence. I became the undisputed chef of the douche and had my own shower daily." She had been perhaps 6 months in that wartime detention for being in the wrong place at the wrong time when, on the occasion the camp was moved, she caught sight of herself in transit in a mirror. The sight was of the oddest-looking creature, bedraggled, in a coat down to her ankles, hung about with tins and clutching several bundles. Suddenly I realised with horror that I was staring at myself. But again she was clever at getting what she wanted, a tiny but private cubbyhole. From that base she worked to help others escape. She considered escaping herself, only in a smuggled, coded message, her husband advised caution, so she stayed put. Sofka taught languages to her fellow internees, as the women organised themselves to survive, and Russian literature, with texts supplied by the Red Cross. She joined the communists among the internees, and together they studied Marx seriously now, and formed a clandestine branch of the party. She was good at spotting sympathetic figures among the French camp staff, a doctor here, a labourer there, and messages and increasingly people got out, while copies of the French communist newspaper L'Humanité were smuggled in. Grey's death, missing in action, was a terrible blow. But by now she was working with the resistance and had no choice but to hold on. More than 200 Polish Jews were one day brought to the camp. When a train appeared in the sidings with its windows blanked out, they knew full well what lay ahead. There were suicides, successful and not. Sofka tried in vain to save whoever she could, including a 5-year-old girl she offered to adopt when the war was over. With tricks, a few were spared the transfer to Auschwitz, and Sofka Skipwith was later honoured by the Israeli state. In the camp, lesbian relationships were formed. Sofka tried it, but she was, as she recalled, so obviously hetero. Years later, MI5, keeping tracks on her because of her communist leaning, would call her oversexed and a typical Chelsea bohemian. Her granddaughter Sofka Zinoviev, who has written a book about her, was more sympathetic when she noticed the sadness in the eyes of the Red Princess, who was her thrillingly unconventional forebear. The war experience was, in a way, Sofka's private and definitive revolution, her welcome to the 20th century, after which she was never the same again. Returning to London and taking up a social engagement in Park Lane, she found she had nothing in common with the people who were, in 1945, as overtly anti-Jewish as they ever had been, absurdly fussy about their food, and felt that France deserved all she got. Noted Sofka, "I was in no mood to argue." One of the happiest experiences of her life was a job that she got before the war through an agency called Universal Aunts, which specialised in placing women in jobs that didn't fit the usual mould of nannies and governesses and domestic help. A kind of half-secretarial skills will travel clearinghouse. She often did translation work, but the day she was asked to be personal assistant to the actor Laurence Olivier and his first wife Jill was the day when all her other accidental social skills came into play, as well as the native wit to do a bit of bookkeeping. They got on wonderfully, and when Larry left Jill for fellow thespian Vivian Lee, it was Sofka who found new places for everyone to live. After the war, Olivier got her to join him at the Old Vic, where she became a playreader, Russian advisor, co-producer, costume advisor. I'm sure the list went on. She, for her part, glutted her need to hear Larry's voice delivering Shakespeare after the misery of the war years. It was only the burden of her son, who had been cared for during the war by acquaintances, that drew her out of full-time work. She wasn't the best of mothers, loving her children, but finding them a nuisance. After the war, her deeply rooted sympathy for the Soviet Union blossomed. Realising that she had to explain herself to a British public in 1968 that, although it was left-leaning, was wary of communism in a still intensifying Cold War, she wrote, "I always agreed with the Soviet novelist Alexei Tolstoy's image that the truth rests on the top of a mountain up whose sides lead many tortuous paths. In any political work, it is essential to believe in the unassailable, exclusive rightness of the path you have chosen to follow. I left the party wishing it well, still considering myself to be a communist." She went on, "My communist activities so horrified my family and former friends that I was regarded as the black sheep, the class traitor, the pariah. It did astonish me to find that in the 20th century, political views were regarded with the same hatred and intolerance by those who did not subscribe to them as were religious differences in the Middle Ages. However, I found many friends of broader views." It can't have been easy, even so. Leo's family, after his premature death, despised his first wife, indeed, as a class traitor and a bolter. By the mid-1950s, Sofka was working for an agency called Progressive Tours and accompanying parties of tourists to the communist bloc. She seemed now to live in trains crisscrossing Europe, a way of building on the restlessness that had become endemic. Soviet Russia was a half-closed country at that time, with many no-go areas and which required all foreign tourists to be kept under a watchful eye. One wonders what she told her group about that painfully drab world, even by British post-war standards, in which the shops were empty and people were so evidently unhappy and unfree. I speak as someone who lived in Moscow for a year in the late 1970s, although I remember that the politically sympathetic British visitors who chose to come often closed their eyes to reality. Sofka's autobiography actually ends in a scene in Moscow where she is having to explain herself to a police chief who insists on knowing her Russian name. And then, when he hears it, he's flabbergasted and salutes her. It's a beautiful, moving piece of writing, as indeed her whole book is. She started the British Soviet Society, whose counterpart today is still a focal point for Friends of Russia, and she wrote a cookery book, Eat Russian, which was another point of entry into her life for me, for I met her when I was compiling my own Food and Cooking of Russia, after wondering how to present some of the ordinary life I had seen for myself. I was myself politically critical of the Soviet Union, more so than Sofka, but at the same time I was quite sure not everything about Russia and Russians amounted to the Cold War and what US President Ronald Reagan would, in a few years' time, call the evil empire. The people, at least, were not the same as the regime, besides which they were suffering. For Sofka, as we can all see today, Russia just went on being Russia, and she was loyal to her native country. She wrote, "Communism was against private property, and very few are prepared to give up their possessions, even to save their own souls and gain the kingdom of heaven." She wasn't a believer, of course. That was just a way of speaking. She went on, "How very much less so to face a period of change and discomfort for the sake of future generations. I never believed, as some did, in the immediate panacea for all evils that public ownership would bring, nor that a complete change of nature would immediately result from socialist education. It would need time, and what, after all, is 100 years in the history of the world?" She went on to make a third long-term partnership with one of those communist tourists she guided about Moscow, and whom she managed to bed without interest noticing. Thereafter, she described her Jim as "my devoted prole," an indiscretion her hauteur as a princess somehow allowed. In any case, as she had early on avowed, she was more inclined to be true to herself than nice. What was she about? A high liver, certainly. She liked to drink and smoke and eat and party. A Russian temperament, said one acquaintance. I loved that. She could drink a lot, but didn't get drunk. She was a sensualist. She loved food, wine, and all that side of things. And she was fascinating, intelligent, poetic, extraordinary. She loved the theatre and was theatrical in life. She hurled herself into the round of days and nights. Oh, yes, and she was physically strong and would arm wrestle with men and win. MI5 stuck to its version of a flamboyant woman who wore outre clothes and was oversexed and unreliable. I like best the view of a family member, as told to her granddaughter, that what made her first husband's family despise her did look then to them like betrayal, but from today's vantage point looks like a historical phenomenon. She lived her extraordinary times as a woman. She was in bed with a demanding, careless and absurd history, and that is something that historians often neglect.
Tonight's 20 Minutes was presented by Leslie Chamberlain and produced in Bristol by Tim Dee. Welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall from me, Martin Handley. The second half of tonight's BBC Prom, live here on Radio 3, the home of the proms. Coming back onto the stage tonight, right now, is the London Symphony Orchestra, whose principal conductor, Valery Gergiev, will guide them and us round Mussorgsky's pictures at an exhibition as brilliantly orchestrated by Ravel. But first, we've the UK premiere of a piece written by Sofia Gubaidulina for the 2002 Gergiev Festival in Rotterdam, and based on the work she says is the centrepiece of all she's done, the Passion and Resurrection of Jesus Christ, according to St. John.
Sofia Gubaidulina is one of the leading figures of our time in the musical world, a great composer, a great personality. I was honored to work with her for the last 25 years, quite many times. And I rarely talk about composers this way, but I think she is able in being now most of her time in Germany, somewhere in a small, quiet village, just writing music, focusing on her own ideas and being in her own world. That's why her compositions are so mysterious and so, I would say, full of curious, enigmatic images.
Valery Gergiev, and the piece he conducts this evening is called The Rider on the White Horse, referring to the first of the four horsemen of the apocalypse, as mentioned in the book of Revelation. "And I saw and behold a white horse, and he that sat on him had a bow, and a crown was given unto him, and he went forth conquering and to conquer. The fearsome image of the rider on the white horse emerging from some kind of whirlwind is the music from the oratorio which opens the orchestral piece, and which Gubaidulina suggests is to do with God's descent to earth. That section is ended by a volley of sound from three drummers and is followed by an orchestral interlude from the oratorio, begun by cellos and basses and ended by the organ. And the final jubilant section then represents the transfiguration and ascension of Christ. Gubaidulina was born in 1931, and as Valeri Gergiev was saying, she now lives in a village in Germany, most of the time anyway. Her music was deemed irresponsible during her studies in Soviet Russia in the 60s because it explored alternative tunings, but she was supported by Shostakovich, just the Shostakovich we heard earlier supported Glazunov. And in evaluating her final examination, he encouraged her to continue down her, inverted commas, mistaken path. So the LSO is packed onto the Albert Hall platform. They make it seem quite small, and we just wait for their principal conductor. And here he comes, Valeri Gergiev, returning to the platform to conduct the LSO in the UK premiere of Sofia Gubaidulina's The Rider on the White Horse. The jubilant close of Sofia Gubaidulina as the rider on the white horse, representing the transfiguration and ascension of Christ, during which Gubaidulina says everything is devoured by fire and light. The UK premiere of the works just been given here in the Royal Albert Hall and live on Radio 3 by the London Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Valery Gergiev. He's worked with Gubaidulina for a quarter of a century now. And Valery Gergiev back on the platform brings the percussion department to its feet. Three bass drums, including the largest I've ever seen. And now the percussion department. We have to mention the organist, Oleg Kinyeev, enjoying himself, getting some extraordinary sounds out of the Albert Hall instrument. Well, the final work on tonight's programme is Ravel's orchestration of Mussorgsky's monument to his recently dead friend, the artist and architect Victor Hartmann, Pictures at an Exhibition. Mussorgsky made his selection of pictures and objects from the St. Petersburg retrospective of Hartmann's work. He soon had the idea of his impressions of various of the exhibits being separated from one another by a repeated promenade section to symbolise his walk from one to the next, sometimes stopping, sometimes passing straight on. And after the first promenade, Mussorgsky stops in front of a sketch of a little gnome running clumsily on crooked legs. Then it's a picture of a medieval castle with a troubadour singing outside. Tuileries shows an avenue in the Parisian gardens with a swarm of children and their nurses. There's a Polish ox cart. Designs for a ballet of the unhatched chicks. Eggs, I suppose. A portrait of two Jews, one rich, one poor. There are French women quarrelling in a market. The picture called Catacombs is an atmospheric watercolour of Hartmann himself with a friend in the Parisian catacombs. Then we get to a furious portrayal of the Russian witch Baba Yaga flying through the air before we arrive finally at the Great Gate of Kiev. Never built, but an impressive oral vision of what was to have been a monument glorifying the Russian people. A brilliant canvas or string of canvases, even in Mussorgsky's, if you like, black and white piano version, from which Ravel made his dazzling colouring in 1922. I asked Valery Gergiev whether he would, the Mussorgsky would have liked Ravel's orchestration. He thought probably not a lot, but he would have been surprised that anybody bothered, because the piece wasn't performed in public in Mussorgsky's lifetime. A few rearrangements have been made. Harpsichord has been moved a little further back so that the celesta player can actually get to sit down. It's the orchestra's first day, first concert back on duty after a two-week holiday. They certainly seem fresh and raring to go. Real buzz about the auditorium, as you can probably hear. And back comes Valery Gergiev, joining the LSO on stage here in the Royal Albert Hall to conduct Ravel's orchestration of Mussorgsky's Pictures at an Exhibition.
Thank you. Thank you.
Mussorgsky's Pictures at an Exhibition, orchestrated by Ravel, ending with those fanciful designs for a very grand Great Gate of Kiev, performed here in the Royal Albert Hall to end this BBC Prom, live, of course, on Radio 3, by the London Symphony Orchestra, led by Carmine Lowry and conducted by Valery Gergiev. Telling me he thinks of Mussorgsky as a real one-off who came out of nowhere, no real connection with previous generations of Russian composers. Focused, said Mussorgsky, on creating an independent Russian product free from German profundity and routine, grown on our country's soil and nurtured on Russian bread. Back comes Valery Gergiev, brings the LSO to its feet. They must be happy to stand again on a concert platform. They've spent 5.5 weeks before their holiday in Aix-en-Provence playing opera, Rigoletto with Gianandrea Noseda and Don Giovanni with Mark Minkowski. Valery Gergiev is looking forward to his holiday. He opened the Edinburgh Festival. He was proudly wearing his Edinburgh Festival t-shirt at rehearsal this morning. Next season he'll be back, well, later this season you might say, with the LSO in Berrios and Scriabin. Philip Dodd playing all those wonderful trumpet solos and the entire trumpet section and brass trombone section. Dudley Bright played that euphonium solo in the ox cart movement. And the saxophone player, Simon Haram, the troubadour. Well, tomorrow at 7 in the first prom of the evening, you can hear another stunning young pianist making his BBC Proms debut when Leeds Piano Competition winner Sunmuk Kim plays Beethoven's drama-filled third concerto with the Bournemouth Symphony Orchestra and its principal conductor, Kirill Karabits. Also on their programme, Janáček's blazing Sinfonietta, and the Proms' Tchaikovsky symphony cycle continues with his third symphony, the Polish. Karabits, Tchaikovsky, always worth hearing, so make a date for tomorrow evening here on Radio 3, home of the BBC Proms, where every note of the season is live. But for now, from a Russian-infused and joyous Albert Hall, I'll hand you on to Ian Skelly at Broadcasting House to guide you through the rest of your Radio 3 evening. Ian.
Martin, thank you very much indeed. Sounds a very full stage indeed at the Royal Albert Hall tonight, and indeed a full audience. Well, you can hear that concert again if you missed it here on Radio 3 on Friday afternoon this week when it forms our Proms repeat during Afternoon on 3. That's at 2 o'clock on Friday. Tomorrow, by the way, a chance to hear the prom that formed our Saturday matinee at the weekend. The trumpeter Alison Balsam joined forces with the Camerata Ireland and the pianist Barry Douglas at Cadogan Hall in London to play music by Britten, Shostakovich, Lennox Barclay and a world premiere of a piece composed back in 1951, Prio Rainier's Movement for Strings. You can hear what it sounds like if you missed that live broadcast at 2 o'clock tomorrow afternoon in Afternoon on 3 with Jonathan Swain. That's here on the home of the BBC Proms, BBC Radio 3. Well, it's just coming up to 5 to 10 now. Very good evening to you from me, Ian Skelly, here to guide you through the rest of our programmes, as Martin said this evening. And we haven't finished with live music tonight. In just over an hour from now, we're going to head to Edinburgh to join the Lake Junction team, who've been very busy gathering plenty of eclectic performances at the Edinburgh festivals today and this week, the international one and the Fringe. You can hear what they've managed to collect when we join Max Reinhardt at 11 tonight, live from Edinburgh. Before then, we have a session from the BBC Proms by Lauren Kinsella. It's the next of our Proms Plus late events at the Royal Albert Hall. Jazz vocals and jazz compositions by this year's winner of the Kenny Wheeler Jazz Prize. You can hear that at 10 past 10 this evening. And then an essay by the artist Maggie Hamlin. It's the first of a series considering the business of portraits, and she'll be taking a look at a self-portrait that she created back in 1978, when her life was, as she says, in something of a muddle. She was spiritually involved with one man and having an affair with another. But what did the teapot, the penguin, the pufferfish and the big tabby cat in the picture all symbolise? Well, you can find out in our essay tonight. Here's Looking at Me. It begins at 11:15. Well, let's continue with the music now, and with a nod to our visit to tomorrow's music at Edinburgh's International Festival. We're live there every morning this week on Radio 3 from 11 o'clock. And tomorrow at the Queen's Hall, you can hear the Australian-born clarinetist Nicola Bowd tracing the musical development of the clarinet with the help of several period instrument performers and singers. Donald MacLeod introduces the concert, and it includes music by Brahms, Schubert, and by a great fan of the clarinet, Mozart. Tomorrow you can hear his trio in E-flat, the Kegelstadt Trio. Well, here he is now, not so much with clarinet in mind, but in the mood for dancing. He was very much in that mood in 1787 when he was appointed the successor to Gluck as court composer for dance music in Vienna. And this is a short selection of just some of the music he produced in that role. It's played on this recording by the Cleveland Baroque Orchestra, conducted by Jeanette Sorrell. Thank you. The music of Mozart, a selection of dances from his days as court composer for dance music. I imagine he was dancing to them himself. Jeanette Sorrell conducted the Cleveland Baroque Orchestra in that recording. And as I say, you can hear more Mozart live from the Edinburgh Festival tomorrow morning from 11 o'clock, when the focus will be on the clarinet. Well, the focus in part tomorrow evening at the Proms will be Janáček. His Sinfonietta opens the Prom, given by the Bournemouth Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Kirill Karabits. So here's a little Janáček now, one of the movements from his tome poem Taras Bulba, composed in the early years of the 20th century. This is The Death of Ostap. Tomáš Netopil conducts the Prague Radio Symphony Orchestra. part of a tome poem depicting the sort of man who killed his son for betraying his nation, Taras Bulba, The Death of Ostap by Janáček. Tomáš Netopil conducted the Prague Radio Symphony Orchestra. And you can hear the Bournemouth Symphony Orchestra under Kirill Karabits tackling Janáček's Sinfonietta tomorrow night at the Proms. Also on the bill tomorrow evening, you can hear Beethoven's Piano Concerto and Tchaikovsky's Third Symphony, the Polish. I shall be at the Royal College of Music earlier in the evening introducing a Proms Plus event discussing the background to Tchaikovsky's Third Symphony. So why not come along to that if you're going to the prom? It starts at 5 tomorrow afternoon. Our first prom with the Bournemouth Symphony Orchestra is at 7. And then we have a late prom, the Tallis Scholars, marking their 40th anniversary, with a programme of music by two of the great Renaissance masters, Carlo Gesualdo and John Taverner. Peter Phillips conducts. We're live at the Royal Albert Hall for that at 10:15 tomorrow night.
Berlioz, Mendelssohn, Bach and Beethoven with the Scottish Chamber Orchestra and one of this year's featured proms artists, the pianist Stephen Hough. Liszt astounded Mendelssohn by sight-reading his first piano concerto in a piano showroom in Paris in 1831. How will Stephen Hough fare with hopefully a little more preparation time? I'm Martin Handley. Join me at the BBC Proms on Monday night at 7 o'clock.